Intersections is recorded, produced, and distributed on the territories that have been stolen from the Coast Salish nations of the Squamish, Musqueam, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. The members of the Gender Empowerment Collective seek to dwell within and reckon with these historical truths of dispossession and violence as we dream and curate conversation towards more whole worlds.
Good morning and welcome to Intersections as presented by the Gender Empowerment Collective. We're here at CITR 109 FM broadcasting from UBC on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Musqueam people. Every 2 weeks on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. we host a panel with collective members or an interview with an expert about topics surrounding gender, race, and social justice. Let's get intersectional.
Hey listeners, and welcome to Intersections. Today we're following up on our last episode talking about gender and the family. My name is Fran and I'm joined by fellow collective member Cora, and our special guest today is Mary Dora. Thank you for joining us today, Mary Dora.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
To start us off, can you please introduce yourself and tell us a little bit more about the work that you do?
Yeah, for sure. So my name is Mary Dora, or MD for short. I am a queer non-binary birth worker based in Toronto. I also do a lot of body work, and I work as a somatic movement practitioner or somatic movement facilitator. And yeah, I'm also a student as well. So I do lots of things.
And can you talk more about the somatic and the birth work aspects of your work, just for our listeners?
Yeah, so I started getting into somatics as a dance artist. So I am also a part-time dance artist, which has taken a pause because of the pandemic. And just thinking more about like longevity of the body, and there's this like myth that dancers will have to retire when they're like 25, which is rooted in a lot of heteropatriarchal status quo stuff. So like finding gentle embodiment practices or practices that will support like better living in some capacity, that are slow and kind of like go against capitalist fast-paced lifestyles. I was really drawn to that. So yeah, like being in my 30s now, like understanding how my body is changing and how it's always changing, but you know, as we get older our bodies start to decline. So just being like really what I choose to do with my body. And so the somatics, really I started getting into birth work a couple years ago, and I realized how supportive having that like body-based experience was for supporting people in transitions of birth and postpartum. And so the two of them kind of just like came together very seamlessly, and I was like, oh yeah, this is a nice thing. And also working with newborns and babies who are basically just nervous systems, doing a lot of like somatic work, not only with like the families or the birthing person, but also with their newborns, is really a nice touch. Working as a doula, it does, yeah, it supports. And also for labor, like just like breathing and feeling your feet, or like, yeah, that is a really big, that was what really drew me to birth work, and also like going through body transitions, whatever they are, whether it's life or death. There's a lot of sometimes there's not really words always for those experiences. So being able to like hold space for people going through these life transitions through the body can be really, can be really supportive.
I love how all of your work interconnects so well. Like, I was just blown away by your kind of portfolio and how everything's crossed with everything else. And it just seemed like super, super interesting. And I'm also so glad that you mentioned this whole heteropatriarchy, whiteness, you know, monolith that we're living within. The last episode that we had as a collective, we were talking about the idea of like a traditional like nuclear family and that kind of family structure. And like there are so many ideas and foundational practices that are built on this whiteness, this heteropatriarchy that you mentioned. Can you speak more about how the medical field and wider society have like excluded trans, queer, gender diverse folks from understandings of birth and family building?
Yeah, for sure. It's a very large topic that I'm still very new to. Like, I'm not, I don't want to act like I know it all, but I definitely am impacted in my own personal life and then also with supporting clients and people navigating the medical industrial complex. And the, it's a really big topic, but I would say, can you repeat your question again? Sorry, I just need to, my neurodivergent brain needs to hear it one more time.
Yeah, that was a very long question with lots of big topics in. So we're just interested in your understanding of birth and family building and how the medical field has excluded so many different folks.
Yes, excluded. That's the word I was looking for, the key word. So, I mean, it's not surprising that birth-related paradigms are often attached to narratives around like the woman and the mother, and it's not, the language and the rhetoric around it is not inclusive of people birthing bodies, birthing people, people that have uteruses, people that have, you know, vaginal canals, like the hormones, the chromosomes. It doesn't really consider the broader spectrum of sex and gender. And so a lot of these narratives deeply impact folks that are on the spectrum, that are occupying like gender liminal spaces or gender expansive experiences. And so, yeah, it impacts them very deeply in negative ways. And it's really hard to find providers that are not only within like the birth world, but just in general for trans and queer and two-spirit folks to find providers that understand that are culturally attuned to the needs of these individuals. And so in birth spaces, a lot of the work that I find I'm doing with 2LGBTQ plus folks is helping support or create a container for them to navigate with these healthcare providers. And, you know, not to say that they're all not aware, like you do get some that are very aware and I right away add them to my reference list. But it's very common that, you know, even just like going through really vulnerable, sensitive experiences and having someone misgender you and having someone assume that you have a partner, or assuming your partner is the opposite to your sex and these types of things can be really, can take you out of your body when you really need to be in it to, you know, get through these really big experiences. So. Yeah, I would say that's the biggest thing, is changing the language that we use around it. And even if a provider doesn't fully understand and they're, you know, working towards learning more, like language is like the first place to start. You know, it's like that's breaking down our like ingrained habits of speaking and communicating to not adhere to the binaries or these types of things. Can really make a huge difference for someone who's navigating a birth or navigating any sort of medical related experience.
Yeah, me and my trans masculine non-binary wife are heading towards the birth process, and we've been dealing with a lot of like those gendered narratives and all that stress that's been putting my wife especially out of their body, like you said. And I heard you say a little bit about supports that you give to your clients. Can you talk a little bit more about that, please? For me?
Yeah, for sure. Yes, for sure. Yeah, so I mean, like getting really like specific, for example, like one thing is, so depending on like where the birth is happening, my experience with midwives, I find that they're pretty good with, most of them are actually really good with using proper language and non-assumptive approaches to care. Person-centered care, I should say. Really, that's what we're striving for here. So that's what I operate within. Like I have like a very, I'm very much person-centered. So I follow, anytime I start working with a client, doesn't matter what their gender expression is or sexual orientation, I will always ask like, what are the words you like to refer to your body? Like what are words you like to call this thing growing inside you, or your experience of feeding, or your experience of when you get misgendered, like how do you want to navigate that arena? Some people don't want to draw attention, and others maybe, you know, it's just, it's very different. Everyone has different feelings around that. So just knowing in the beginning, like what those are for me, so that we can have sort of start to create like a more brave space together. And then from there, once we've discussed those things, it's, the conversation might shift towards like, once we're in a medical space, like how do we want to set up the container so that you feel most supported? So that could go something along the lines of, like, I'll make like little signs to put on the door to say like solo parent by choice, or I had these signs that said like, well, what were they? It was something about, it's been a while. Something about like, this is a baby, and the baby, we don't know the baby's gender yet. I wish I could show you. I wish I had them handy. I think they're somewhere in my files back there. But just like identifying the fact that like they won't be assigning a gender to this baby. And so making little signs that will make that very clear. And I think a big thing as well is making sure that, depending if I'm supporting someone that has a partner with them, working collaboratively with that partner to support the birthing person around, you know, I'd rather follow their cues because they would know their partner better than I would in that moment. And so also having a relationship with the partner as well, and kind of focusing care on them equally rather than just focusing on the one that's birthing, because both, you know, both individuals, or if there's multiple individuals involved, have a part to play. So, but yeah, the biggest thing I would say is like signage definitely helps. And yeah, I've gotten some like nurses be like, oh, that's so sweet. Like they usually like it because then I like put colors on the door, and then, you know, they know they're entering into this like space that is like a queer space, you know, so be mindful of that, you know, and also having name tags. Like I've brought like little name tags with gender markers. I have like little sticky ones that you put on. Yeah, that's like one example of the things, most of the things I do with clients.
Yeah, that sounds like a really wholesome and holistic experience. Like you're very much creating, like you said, a container that holds what people need in it. Like that. That's really cool. So next thing is you also talk about abortion support on your website, and I'd like to hear a little bit more about what that entails and like where you fall on reproductive rights.
Yes, of course. So, you know, choosing to have produce life or not is a choice everyone has, and abortion support is, doula support for abortions is so important, and not something people even think is an option, which is, I mean, when I experienced it, I did not have support, and I look back and I'm like, wow, I would have loved a doula. And it's actually an organization I work for in Toronto, and there's one in Hamilton as well, called Birthmark. And they actually offer free abortion support to anyone, and it's referral, self-referral system, which is amazing. And yeah, so I, in terms of abortion support, I'm actually like newer to supporting professionally, like professionally as a doula supporting abortions. I've done a lot of like abortion support in my community with friends. I would say my first exposure to birth work was supporting friends through abortions. So that was always kind of like my, I guess, I never thought about it. And then one day I was like, yeah, I've definitely supported folks through abortions since I was like in my 20s. And yeah, it's something I know in Toronto, there are access to abortions pretty easily. Like there's a lot of different places, whether that's in a hospital or private clinics. There's even a clinic that focuses on queer and trans health as well. So yeah, it's definitely needed, and it's really important to have that support in place. And just knowing like the options, like, and what it will be like, because it can be really hard and scary.
Thinking back to our last episode again, we also talked about how pregnancy, birth, and postpartum like takes a physical toll on the person who carries the child. However, like the postpartum toll is not always recognized, and there's often like an expectation to have overwhelming happiness, you know, upon birth. In your work, how do you challenge these ideas and promote healing?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of, I guess we're talking specifically about like postpartum afterwards. Yeah. Yeah. So I almost feel like there's so much emphasis, and this is what I've learned from my trainings and from working with mentors in this field. There's a lot of emphasis put on the birth, the prenatals and the birth, which, you know, it's important. And when I first started as a doula, I was like, oh, like I didn't even consider postpartum. I was just like, oh, I'm going to help with births, and that's what that is. And then the more I got into birth work, the more I was like, you know, postpartum is actually, I don't want to say it's more important, but like, if you're in postpartum for your whole life, like I know they say it's like 6 months or 6 weeks after, that's like the medical, you know, if you have a midwife, they stay with you for up to 6 weeks. But really, it's like a lifelong experience until at least, you know, your child is an adult, you know, you're postpartum forever. So I think just acknowledging that, and I find that when I do like prenatal support, I also do childbirth education, my conversations around postpartum usually emphasize, if there's partners involved, emphasize talking a lot about grief, and whether that's like grief of your relationship with your partner or partners, grief with your relationship to yourself and the time that you had, also with your extended family, your chosen family, like limited time with friends. There's a lot of grief in that process, and also just having a new human in your family circle to get to know, and on top of that, figuring out how to nourish and take care of both you and the new life. It's a lot, and it's, I think we would be cutting ourselves short, and I would be cutting my clients short if I didn't say that and spend a significant amount of time talking about that, because yeah, you don't want to like get to that point and then think that it's just like, ta-da, we're here with this new child. And yeah, there's a lot of, it's a challenge. And so setting them up for knowing this and setting them up for success. So like, it's really like a lot of it can be like time managing or like setting schedules, like food trains, for example. Food trains are like, I would say like one of the number one things. Having people bring you food or having food prepared in some kind of way, whether that's like pre-chopping things and freezing them so you can just like throw them on a pan, or like throw them in the thing to make soup, smoothies, lots of fluids, food preparation, nourishment is a whole other thing that I could talk about forever. And also other things like just having someone to like hold baby for you so you can sleep, you and your partner can sleep, especially at nighttime. The first few weeks can be really lacking. Like, sleep is like endemic among parents. So yeah, those are just some examples, but I think a lot of it is focusing on like the bond with the partner, the partners, or with the self, acknowledging that, and then yeah, making sure that there's supports in place, so people can feel like they have little pockets of like, okay, I can shower now, I can take a poop freely. Which sometimes you take those things for granted before. You're like, oh, pooping alone? No one thinks about that, but that's a huge thing that, you know, it's like, I just want to take a poop by myself.
That was such an awesome way to end that whole like section. And in terms of that wider narrative though of, you know, the happiness and the harmony that you're meant to attain almost instantly, like, what are your thoughts on how we change that as a broader society? You know, like, I appreciate you're talking to individuals and supporting them one by one. How can we enact that shift at a broader level?
That's a good question, and that's like a really big question, because I think like a lot of it is what we see in like the media or what we see on movies and TV, this idea of like, you know, the nuclear family and everyone has their role in that. I think changing the narrative around that. Also, like, a lot of the time, like, having support groups, even like in hospitals, like, just if they had, they put up flyers about like how to body feed or breastfeed and how to do this, like, you know, putting more emphasis on the postpartum aspect of health. And I mean I'm sure there's lots of other ways, and I feel like something I would have to really think more about, but I think that just people changing their narratives, and even just like talking honestly, like I feel like a lot of new parents or like parents who give birth feel very like alone during the postpartum period, and so they feel like their experience of the birth is not, no one will understand it, or they just, I think the lack of like community care and support can make people feel isolated, and so I'm always looking in Toronto and virtual spaces as well, like, for different postpartum support groups, because I know that there is like a handful, and there, I have like go-to referral places. Even the organization I work for offers a postpartum support group, and even one for queer and trans folks as well. Just having those spaces. And one of the positives of the pandemic in this virtual land we've created is that there's a lot of support groups like globally, you know what I mean? And when we're talking about like queer and trans support, being in a postpartum support group with people that share your lived experience is like a night and day experience. So I think when we can extend our tendrils out to like the greater global community, we can find places for connection, with more accessibility to that type of connection and community. I know for myself, even just as like a queer non-binary doula, I've been able to connect with other doulas who are similar to my lived experience and learn from them. Maybe they have more experience than me through the virtual sphere. So I feel like my network goes like beyond my like Toronto bubble, and it can like go towards like different places in the world, which is really nice.
Yeah, I really like this idea of building community. Me and my wife are collecting other trans people who are about to give birth as well, so that we can have that exact thing you're talking about. I'm glad it's a good idea.
Yeah, very good idea. I think that's amazing.
Could you talk a little bit about how these non-standard family constructions, like non-nuclear heteropatriarchal families, like handle and play out the birthing process, like before and then also in the postpartum, how gender roles roll out?
There's a lot of, I love how versatile bodies are and our abilities, the body's way of supporting life is quite fascinating. You know, there's a lot of, I mean, the first thing I guess I'll say is non-nuclear families, like, and maybe nuclear families as well, it depends on the person's body and their capacity for reproduction. But I think that there's a lot of intention that goes into choosing to make a family when it's non-nuclear settings, but also within the nuclear setting. It just really depends on people's bodies. And so I think that a lot of the time queer trans families, to the process to conceive and the preconception process can be for some really challenging. And so making a choice to create life and have a family is, there's a lot of like build up to that moment when that happens. And so it's, you know, there's a certain amount of privilege in this work. And so privilege with being able to just conceive, you know, in the standard heteropatriarchal way, also privilege with even like feeding, depending on how you feed, right? If you can feed with your body, if you want to feed with your body, your experience of that, and the ways that we can support a new life that's not just, you know, this the typical binary man, woman, like mother, father setting. Even right down to like, you know, ways of feeding baby. So like, you know, for example, I've supported some friends who had a baby and they were two lesbians, and one of them decided to have the baby in their body to grow the baby, and the other one decided that she would feed the baby with her body. And, you know, that's like one example. It's like, I love how in queer family settings, there is really no, oftentimes there's less chance to fall into these like binary gendered roles, because people are both equally taking part in growing and the development of their child, their children. And I think that that's really, really amazing. Even down, like, you know, there's like supplementary body feeders that you can get. Like, there's so many like creative ways that you can both take part in that process. And I think it's really special and, yeah.
Yeah, we touched on something similar to that in the panel episode. We discussed some research that talked about how, and this is a bit of a loaded phrase, but the diverse families want children more because they have to go through so many different difficulties to get that child to exist in this world. And then afterwards, the roles that they wind up playing are more based on want rather than expectation.
Mm-hmm. I think that, like, going back to what I said about like bodies are amazing, because like they really truly are amazing, and the ways that we can co-create life together and support life that extends beyond the status quo of what we think is, you know, the norm, and just knowing that there's other options out there aside from what the standard medical system tells us. Yeah, it can be liberating and empowering to know that, like, you know, the supports are there, you know, and the frustrating part is that not a lot of people, it's not readily known, like this information is so nuanced, and to get to really understand like fertility, queer fertility, queer baby making is, yeah, it's requires your own, a lot of like self advocacy and learning about these things. And that's sometimes when like fertility doulas, queer fertility doulas can come into play. And that's an area I really want to get into more, and I'm still learning a lot about that. And learning about the intricacies of like fertility for trans folks. And yeah, it's a whole wonderful experience to know that there's options there and have support around it is important.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is about all the time we've got, but so people can help find themselves information, can you tell us a little bit more about where we can find more about you and your work?
Yeah, for sure. I have a website. It's somaticpractice.ca. And also that's my Instagram handle, somaticpractice. So you can find me there. And Facebook too, same handle. I work at Birthmark in Toronto, so you can also check out some of their services there. They have a program for queer and trans community called Seeds and Sprout, which I also support as well. I'm a part of that program. And yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was so nice to chat.
Yeah, it was lovely to have you on. I feel like I got a lot out of this. So thank you very much personally as well.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
The 21st edition of Doxa Documentary Film Festival returns May 5th to 15th, 2022. Committed to cultivating curiosity and critical thought, Doxa will present both short and feature films from across Canada and the globe, representing some of the best in documentary cinema. The hybrid in-person online festival will include both live and pre-recorded conversations with filmmakers, as well as some industry-specific events. Visit doxafestival.ca for more details.
Hey, what's wrong?
I want to go to therapy, but I can't afford it.
Well, did you know there's a show on CITR where you can get free therapy every other week?
Really? What's it called?
It's called Therapy Hour, and it airs every other Tuesday at 6 p.m.
You mean I can get free therapy every 2 weeks just by listening to the radio?
That's right, and it doesn't even cost you a dime.
Wow, I won't have to cry anymore.
Actually, crying is pretty good for you. I learned that by listening to Therapy Hour on CITR 101.9 FM, because everyone needs therapy.
But not everyone can afford it. You get what you need.
All right, hello everyone, and welcome back. This is Hal, and we are talking with Dr. Amanda Watson today.
Dr. Amanda Watson is a professor of sociology and anthropology at Symer Frazier University and the author of Juggling Mother. And I'm Bella, as I forgot to mention. Thank you so much for joining us today, and we can jump right into our questions. So to start us off, would you be able to introduce yourself and a little bit about your areas of research, please?
Sure. First of all, thank you so much for having me. I have listened to your work and I am so inspired at actually learning a lot just hearing students like talk about these issues that have been sort of roiling. So it's really a pleasure. I am Amanda Watson. I'm a lecturer at Simon Fraser University in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology. My PhD is in feminist thought, and I study representations in popular media and culture, and also policy and welfare state and theory, specifically in the areas of gender and racialized labor, divisions of labor in the home, but family formation in general and sort of critical intersectional feminist political economy of work and family.
Sounds great. So to get us started, we wanted to ask about how you first became interested in this field, particularly talking about the gender division of labor.
Oh, that one's an easy one for me, because I always go back to like how it was like a passion from childhood, I think. I grew up in a family of a heterosexual couple and four kids in the suburbs of Vancouver, and I watched my parents struggle with labor. And I didn't realize that I was not typical in this way, I guess, to really like fixate on their navigation and their and the stress and tension that sort of resulted, and the kind of like ways in which our society really downloads a lot of responsibility for family formation on the parents or the adults in a family unit. And I went to UBC to study something and realized that I kept sort of writing about this central question I had around family work and why we've organized things this way and power. And the questions didn't really become formed until I really like as I graduated my PhD. So I've sort of been like stumbling and thinking about these like histories and legacies of the family and love and care and kinship and relationality and like even multi-species relationships until I found myself pregnant and writing a book about this, especially the pressures on mothers.
So actually, I wanted to hear a little bit more about that. I noticed that in a lot of your research, you emphasize kind of the gendered aspects of the family. And I kind of am interested in hearing more about how you think that what you would call like gendered family expectations can impact mental health, especially during the pandemic.
Yeah, that's a great question. That's one I think that we are increasingly concerned about, which I think is reason for some optimism. I think I found headlines about this in the pandemic to be quite validating. When we've known for a long time, whether it's like on the philosophical side, like the feminist theoretical side, or you know, the psychological side, that mothers are disproportionately impacted by, you know, overburdens, you know, with respect to work and invisible work, but also the depression and anxiety consequences of that overburden. And I was really interested in how we began talking about this in the pandemic, how it seemed to sort of like come into a popular conversation in a new way. But I also have found maybe a bit cynically, our critique tends to rely on heteronormative ideas about family and kinship. So even as we uplift the work that disproportionately women are doing and visibilize it, which feminists have been trying to do for since capitalism, but especially since the 60s and 70s, I think we it's hard not to slip into and reproduce notions of couples and of this traditional family that exists in like a household. And so I've been working with students and to try to push our analysis like through daydreaming and thinking with queer authors, you know, to think about like, how can we do both? How can we point out and disrupt heterosexist and misogynist expectations, and also think outside of the myth that this sort of family setup will ever protect us?
Wow, that's really, really interesting to think about. And in terms of this heteronormative family that you've been mentioning a little bit, do you think that this has a direct impact on the children, less or in addition, I suppose, to the parents, especially like young girls?
Oh, that's such a good question. I've been thinking about how we typically ask this question. I've, you know, read research about the impact of particular parenting formations or parenting styles on children. And typically when we ask these kinds of questions, we need like metrics of the impact on children, right? So we say like, their academic success or their, whether or not they go to prison. Like there's all these like myriad ways in which we evaluate outcomes of family formation. And I think what happens in this line of questioning is we fail to situate the child as a member of the community and also as a member of society. And we atomize a kind of success story. And what makes me, when I'm thinking about how to consider the child, I actually think about Andrea Doucette's work on fathers in Canada. She doesn't study the child at all, but she interviews fathers who spend time with children or who have a period of being the stay-at-home parent. And in her really thorough analysis of masculinity, she really explicates the ways in which fathers express a kind of attachment to both the caregiving that they're doing, but also kind of like traditional masculinity with respect to work and paid work in particular. And I just think to myself when I read this, there is a bigger picture here with respect to the benefits and harms on children if we think about societal change. So if we think about, for example, time spent between a father and a child as chipping away at toxic masculinity, then how is that not a benefit for the child, right? So so I guess I didn't really answer your question, but I when I think about, like, to get back to sort of like the impact on girls, it makes me reflect on my own sort of witnessing of you know, like a patriarchal structure in a marriage and a family, and the economic kind of infrastructure of a suburban home and all that that entails, two earners and, you know, paycheck to paycheck sometimes. And I think that that did cause me a lot of harm. You know, I think that we put a lot of pressure on children to adapt to a really stressed out unit. And so in those relationships, there is stress, and there is always the possibility for violence or neglect or the inability to center the child. And what really made this come clear to me in the pandemic is how stressed I was when I lost childcare and still teaching. I had the kids like hanging off the side of my laptop. They were 1 and 3 at the time. I was this close to publishing my book, and I was expended. I have no other word. I was beyond stressed, and I was uncharacteristically snapping and irritable and unable to be relational. And I think, like, okay, these are extreme conditions in my life because of the privilege that affords me to typically share this kind of labor, but we are setting families up for this. And Indigenous blogger wrote this sort of like ode to child-centered parenting and put it as like, children are not getting in our way to work. Our work is getting in the way of children. I was like, oh, it was gutting, and it confronted me, and that has stuck with me.
Yeah, on that topic, I want to touch on how you talked about the heteropatriarchy earlier. In our last episode, we discussed what family structure and workload can look like in queer and non-traditional families and just non-standard North American families. So would you like to share some insight into how gendered labor works, particularly in queer families or polygamous families or families of choice in North America?
That's a great question. This is sort of outside of my research area. So what I remember comes from kind of grad school coursework on these kinds of topics. My understanding from most studies is that we have a myth of the heteronormative setup that we stick to queer families. And so there's this sort of like heterosexist assumption that in queer relationships, expressions of masculinity and femininity will translate to gendered labor and gender roles. And my understanding is that that's not true. And our fixation with this question is instructive in and of itself, right? Like, why do we need to know how whether or not our expressions of gender translate to these gender divisions of labor? And so that's on the one side. But I also, what comes to mind also is how even in queer or chosen or gay relationships that are folded into the shape of the traditional family, we sometimes see evidence of borrowing of tropes that reproduce heteronormative ideals. And I'm thinking specifically about the white wedding, the North American wedding, and Arendt's work on how her subjects, her interviewees, one of whom identified as a lesbian, she opens her analysis with this quote, explaining how she would be the one wearing the white dress, and her partner, who she hasn't met yet and she will meet one day and get married, will be wearing the tux because they'll probably be a more masculine woman. But if she's the more masculine woman, she will be the one wearing the tux. And so, so we still have especially when we look to like, you know, what Dean Spade would call like this, like homo, or like Jasbir Puar would critique as this like homo national example of a family form. So I think both are happening. We've got real resistance to these kinds of oppressive divisions of labor. And at the same time, we have cultural scripts that promise a kind of folding into, you know, belongingness if one sees themselves in these fantasies. And as a cis hetero person myself, I am only able to sort of comment on what I see in the literature and can't really get inside the question to be like, you know, metacognitive about that experience.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's something that we touched on a bit in the past episode, because we talked a lot about how some standard North American or non-standard North American families feel the need to legitimize the relationship by imitating kind of heterosexual ideals or just your traditional ideas. And that's something that a lot of us had experienced in our own life, because we are trying to uplift these ideals in order to prove that we had a real relationship. So it's definitely something that resonated with us.
Yes, that is so smart to be mindful of. And also, I think just as I'm hearing you say that, I think like we're all just products of it. So as we resist and as we reflect, like we are unlearning. We're always in the process of unlearning. So of course, if we take our cues from work on intergenerational struggle and trauma, then of course we're going to be doing this sort of like reproduction. Like our fantasies are going to be complicated. And so I'm really inspired by this like commitment to kind of queering the family or like displacing ideas about what is a standard family to begin with.
A Tribe Called Red is the Hallucination with their new record, One More Saturday Night, featuring Javier Mighty, Tanya Tagak, and more, out now.
TransCare BC works to enhance the coordination of trans health services across the province and offer expanded health services to support transgender communities. They are doing this by developing gender-affirming client-centered models of service, ensuring access to gender-affirming and supportive healthcare that is equitable and available, and supporting network development to make sure trans and gender-diverse individuals, their families, and healthcare providers have access to information, resources, and support. Check out phsa.ca to learn more about this program and lend your voice to help create an inclusive and supportive system for trans members of our community.
Yeah, that's definitely something that we, or even I remember mentioning in our last episode, that I was just kind of shocked at like what we call a standard family. But really quick, I wanted to circle back to what you were mentioning earlier about living as a mother during the pandemic. I watched the short documentary video, YouTube video that you were in called I Learn as a Mother. I thought it was really inspiring and really beautiful. But you mentioned at a point in the video that during the pandemic, you kind of reached your, I don't know, breaking point, so to speak, where you kind of realized that like the way you were caring for others and not caring for yourself just wasn't sustainable. And I was just wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more on that and how that, I guess, pushed you to make changes with the relationships within your family.
Oh, thank you for your kind words about that. That was a nerve-wracking experience for me, but also a really rewarding one. I was in some denial about that part of my internalized misogyny, I think. You know, like I was also in some denial about the physical consequences of rejecting our own bodily needs. I, you know, hadn't quite been that tired before, I think, you know, and or that stress, that anxious, and that lacking, you know, that isolated, without a support network at the age that I was and the age that my kids were. So, but I mentioned the denial first because it's odd, I think, that I hit this wall without, like, given what I study, because I was like actually writing about this at the time, and still I found myself in this like systemically oppressed, but also, as I mentioned a little bit in the film, but also in my book, like still tied to this ideal of being able to make this all work through my own care labor. So I would critique this on the one hand and like reproduce it on the other. And that was a painful realization. And really it was my denial of my body that allowed that to go on for as long as it did. And the second my body reminded me that I am a body, it couldn't go on any longer. And so I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful it stopped before it went any further. But it brings me back to embodiment and all of the wonderful kind of activist literature we have in zines and art, like just get in your body again and love it and stop killing it.
Yeah, I think when we have conversations about the pandemic, a lot of it is very tied to capitalism and to our culture surrounding economics and jobs at this time. So I wanted to ask about how expectations on motherhood are shaped by capitalism and by productivity culture in North America right now.
There's a lot of, that's a wonderful question. I think there's a lot of literature on what is a good worker. You know, the ideal worker is not challenging to conjure. We can think about this person as like resilient, doesn't call in sick, responsible, works late. And I think that when we have a sort of a generation or two socialized in a neoliberal era, the way my generation was, you know, I was born in the 1980s. These ideals were all around us and our parents were the first real wave of dual earning couples in the context of capitalist North America. Of course, we should expect that those social values would be applied to all of our labors. I think that's my most succinct answer. So there's research on, you know, intensive mothering and the extent to which mothers engage in these kind of controlling behaviors with their kids as outgrowths of their own anxiety and their inability to control, you know, like the insecurity of the world. And I buy those arguments as well, but I really relate to the idea that we should expect, if we consider motherhood as one role among the many we have and as involving work, you know, in the midst of our slate of other kinds of work, that of course we would expect this of ourselves in order to feel successful. And all the kind of guilt that people describe as mom guilt, like I had that guilt as a worker.
Wow, thank you. So next I wanted to discuss a little bit about your book. I noticed that one of the main kind of central points or the arguments was that the juggling mother, as you say, is a model neoliberal worker who upholds white privilege. And I wanted to ask how you think that current cultural norms regarding gender within the family kind of can intersect with racism or other inequalities that we're facing as a society, like ability or gender or class even.
That's really a good question. Like I think about work on like the Exalted Citizen by Sunera Tobani at UBC, or like the Ascendancy of Whiteness by Jasbir Puar in the US. I think what the model neoliberal worker as applied to motherhood implies is a resilience, an overcoming, a commitment to individual responsibility. And the flip side of that is the erosion of community. It is a rejection of relationality and a rejection of non-monetized connection. And so if we think about what that means, that ways of living and ways of knowing in community then are devalued actively. They're eroded by this performance of this like exalted neoliberal subject and mother. And that's sort of like a painful confrontation because it's hard, I think, not to do right by how you were conditioned. And the convergence of doing right by my own kids and what I was reading about community, like it slipped together in my mind until I was able to like, and say like, okay, the more that this worker with relative power and privilege remains stuck to this ideal, the more harm is done. And that person is in a position of being oppressed. And that, I think, was like the tough nut to crack. That was like, okay, now I have to write this book because this person is facing, you know, systemic oppression because of capitalism and misogyny and violence, you know, and also they are, in order to protect themselves, clinging to their power, abiding by the rules, and they're being gatekeepers and they're not reaching out, and that is actively harming. It actively stigmatizes forms of asking for help and helping.
To touch on another main point of our your book, you mentioned that we are conditioned into certain gender roles. So I wanted to ask how the media represents gendered family dynamics and how that impacts how we replicate motherhood.
Ooh, I think that's my favorite topic. thank you for your question. People often ask me about like what I mean by conditioning, and I am obsessed with how we respond to media. I think following cultural theorists like Stuart Hall, you know, like we are allowed to take the cultural temperature when we look around us and think about how we're consuming things. And that's not that I would say, you know, there's a causal relationship between this ad that I glance at and this purchase that I make, but that it forms, you know, the thing that allows us to make sense of the world and communicate. And okay, so. Can you repeat your question? So you want to know how media is shaping expectations of motherhood?
Yeah, and how that changes how people replicate motherhood.
Oh, okay. What I find fascinating about what I think is happening now or in the last 5 years is what I would call this sort of like shift toward humor around mothering and working as a mother. I'm thinking about Working Moms. I don't know if you're familiar with this like CBC title, or Bad Moms by Mila Kunis, but there's other ones. There's like an Australian one about breastfeeding. There's like some more raw representation. So I actually think it's not that we still have this sort of like saintly, dutiful mother. Like I feel like instead actually what we are seeing around us is this juggling mother, is the mother who's actually like on the verge of you know, burnout all the time. And while it is validating to see this and fun to laugh along, and I enjoy these things that I also sometimes hate watch, and like enjoy seeing like this like farcical aloof dad in advertising, I think what is dangerous about this moment is how we are using humor to prop up a new form of this ideal. We are reinforcing this role and allowing women to see themselves in this, but not actually disrupting the trappings of what we should consider responsible motherhood. And so I've written elsewhere about how if you really like dig deep into characters in these portrayals or characters in ads, the mother is still doing the most. She never actually rejects her kids. Like she doesn't resent, she doesn't regret, she doesn't burn her marriage down. She doesn't actually lose her job. She's definitely not collecting food stamps. And so we actually aren't seeing a ton of resistant representation. I love representation of rage that we've seen in art and film in the last even just 2 years. But there's still room to think about, you know, what would actually be taboo? What would be taboo? What is too much to represent around us? And how does the fact that we're not seeing, you know, cultural taboos represented, what does that tell us about what's still idolized and like our way of conditioning to that ideal?
Yeah, I really liked what you said about how kind of media is representing almost overworking yourself to the point of burnout, but it never actually comes. But it's just, I don't know, I feel like it really forces mothers in our society to feel that that's okay and that's acceptable, and obviously they can relate to it. I don't know, I just, it's really interesting, kind of a paradoxical thing to think about. But now a quick 180, I wanted to talk a little bit about the climate crisis, which I noticed kind of some of your research kind of was focusing on. I wanted to get your opinion on what you think about people who are saying it's unethical or that they shouldn't be having children because of the state of our planet, like so things like the birth strike movement. Mm.
Yeah. Like, how sad is it that we have to think about the ethics of our desires to reproduce or not. Like I just reject this individualist response to climate disaster so wholeheartedly, so enthusiastically. The birth strike movement is something I've spent a bit of time thinking about. What fascinated me, so just to give a little background to anyone listening who's not familiar, it was started by the head of a punk rock band, Blythe Pepino, in the UK. And it was a response to Extinction Rebellion, this climate movement that's really popular in the UK, and their perception that Extinction Rebellion was male dominated and that it wasn't strategizing with like women's fears and needs in mind. And so I thought, okay, that's interesting. It's also spearheaded by this like white able-bodied woman in the global economic north, right? Like in England in particular. And their like strike from giving birth, the pledge they called it, I think brings up population control rhetoric. And we can't really analyze the movement without that background. And at the same time, the group really actively rejected that characterization in media and said, look, this is a strategy in a similar way to, you know, like Silvia Federici's wages against housework was a strategy 50 years ago. This is not actually that we think we should have to strike from giving birth. We're being extreme to say, look how scared we are and look how urgent this is. So that was their strategy, but it was constantly being misunderstood in the media, misrepresented, like in the same pieces that would analyze the birth strike movement, the journalists would then pivot to a UBC study from 2017 that said, that showed that, you know, the most important thing you can do for your carbon footprint is have one fewer child. So people just collapsed these discourses into one another. And I think that was so horrible. I think any kind of like individualist neoliberal response that blames people for their kin, their making of kin, is just such, but it's seductive. It's seductive because of course we want to be like vegan and, you know, it falls into those categories of like ethical consumption and moving through the world in like a harm reduction kind of way. Yeah, that's what I think. I think it's crap. So I think like responses that would be healthier involve asking why we would get to the point where we would think individuals could solve this through their birthing politics. And also, what does it assume about reproductive autonomy and justice and access? But I'm far more compelled by like the daydreaming of students around making their families and thinking, you know, ethically about how they want to sustain life and live well together. So I guess my question now in my own research is, how are young adults dreaming about this in the context of climate crisis in particular, but also because I'm in Metro Vancouver, like housing and childcare and opioid use and missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. Yeah. So it's a crisis time that I'm just so curious about.
That's really helpful. Thank you. I think that every generation that has to think about having a family kind of has something similar, but maybe not as exasperated as what we have right now to deal with. But I think that's a really, really well way of putting it. As we come to the close of the interview, I just wanted to ask if you wouldn't mind giving, I guess, a quick summary, a quick conclusion of your research and your interests, and then also where we could find you on social media and where we could hear some more of your work.
Sure. Well, I'm interested in all things like family reproduction. And so I've got two projects on. One, the one I was just mentioning, is called Imagine Kin. And it asks like young people, you know, to think about their desires. And I'm just really curious to hear the language that we're using to talk about how we dream about our kind of utopian vision for living well together and like dying well together. And how people are imagining climate as they think about their own growth. And the other project that I'm really excited about too is called the Parent Feelings Project. This is a little closer to my experience, but I'm asking parents about like how they envision their roles as guardians and parents and caregivers for their children. And it sounds like maybe like a basic wide open question, but what's motivating me is a real turn in popular parenting literature toward social justice parenting and forms of passive parenting or patient parenting, being nicer parents. So I want to know like how people of my generation really, especially with parents that have like a lot of their survival needs met and are thinking about what they like should be doing and have they're doing, if they're doing it right, if they're reading the right anti-racist books to their kids, you know, like how these parents are articulating what they think they're trying to do. So that's also on the horizon. You can reach me on all socials at Spin Doctor Dr. Watson. It started out as like my bike handle and stuck, so it's like a bit dorky, but yeah, I'm happy to engage there, and I often post about like calls for participants and stuff like that. So I always love to have people to speak to and circulate like essays and stuff. So thank you.
So with that, we have reached the end of our episode. We want to say thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your work and your insights with us.
Thank you so much for having me. That was the most prepared an interview panel has ever been for any interview I've ever had in my life.
Thank you.
What a pleasure. Take care.
Thank you so much.
For listening to Intersections, presented by CITR's Gender Empowerment Collective at 101.9 FM. We can always be reached by email at genderempowerment@citr.ca or on Instagram at genderempowerment_CITR for comments, feedback, and topic ideas. You can find our episode archive and show notes at citr.ca/radio/intersections. This episode of Intersections was made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program. Our theme song is provided by John Allison Weiss. Tune in again in 2 weeks on Tuesday at 10 a.m. to catch our next episode.